From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Vice President Mike Pence is meeting today with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in Tampa to discuss the state's response to COVID-19. Cases are hitting record highs again across the U.S. More than 50,000 people were diagnosed yesterday.
Despite the surge, Florida Governor DeSantis says he is not going back on reopening plans. Let's bring in Natalie Dean, who is an assistant professor of biostatistics at the University of Florida. She specializes in emerging infectious diseases. Natalie, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've been focused on new data coming in and what they mean. So what is the coronavirus situation like now in Florida?
Right now in Florida, we're seeing a very steep increase in the number of new cases each day. And there was some question about whether that was attributable to more testing. But what we're seeing at the same time is an increase in the test positivity. So that is the fraction of tests that come back positive. If we were just doing more testing and there was no change in the underlying outbreak, then that number would go down. But we're seeing a sharp increase in that number, along with the increase in number of new cases, which suggests that we have a real brewing outbreak, a brewing problem in our state.
And how would you characterize that brewing outbreak? Is it people across all age groups?
So there's wide variability across who's being infected and what particular age groups. Right now, we're seeing a big epidemic in younger adults, and that may reflect the fact that younger adults have changed their behavior. They're interacting more, going to bars. It also may reflect that more people are back at work. But the fact that it's among younger adults, I mean, that's good in the sense that younger adults are not as high risk, but we know that they can also transmit to others in their communities. So even when there's more spread among younger adults, that can easily spread over into the high-risk population. And so what I expect to see, and we're starting to see a little bit, is an increase among older adults in infections. And that's where we're going to start to see the increase in hospitalizations and deaths.
We should say that it seems the pace of COVID-19 deaths has been down compared to earlier in the pandemic. Do you think that's because it's younger people who seem to be infected now? Or do you think it has more to do with people learning about how to treat the coronavirus and how to treat it right away?
My feeling is the biggest explanation is that the changes that we're seeing in the epidemic are recent. The sharp rise in increase in cases is just within the last few weeks. And we know that there are lags that occur from the time that someone's infected in the community until when they're identified as being sick, till when they may need hospitalization, and until when they may die. So we expect some lag until for the hospitalization numbers and the death numbers to catch up. And also, as I said, you know, if the outbreak is starting in younger adults and then it spills over into older adults later, then there will be even further lags. So while we may not see an increase in hospitalizations immediately, although we are seeing increases in some places across the state, we expect a bigger increase later on.
If we mentioned the meeting between Vice President Mike Pence today and Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis. If you were invited and you could have your say as someone who studies the numbers very carefully, what would you advise? How would you advise them?
I would want to tell them that the numbers are going to continue to rise, and there's a certain amount that's already set in motion. So we need to plan, we need to act according to what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks. You know, we need to act now, because whatever we do now, it takes a while for that to actually have an effect. And so there needs to be a willingness to take stringent measures and to talk seriously about stepping back on certain activities, because whatever's happening now, it's going to take some time for those interventions to actually stop what's happening in the future.
Although, as we said, the governor says he's not going back. And this is a question we asked an epidemiologist in California yesterday. So vamping off that, what is your message to the people of Florida ahead of the 4th of July weekend and to the governor?
I know that we're all really tired of social distancing and this way of life that is so abnormal. But the reality is that the virus is still out there, and actually it's out there in bigger numbers than even before. And so when we think about our plans for the 4th of July, The last thing we want is for some joyful celebration to turn into something where our loved ones get infected and get sick. No one wants that. So being very intentional about risk-reducing behaviors and keeping our groups very small.
Natalie Dean, biostatistician at the University of Florida in Gainesville. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
A look now at Oklahoma, where voters approved an expansion to the state's Medicaid program this week. The ballot measure in the deeply red state just barely passed, but it will change the state's constitution and expand coverage to tens of thousands of low-income people. Oklahoma is the first state to expand Medicaid during the pandemic, and it may be a bellwether as economic conditions deteriorate across the country. Politico healthcare reporter Rachel Rubin joins me now. Rachel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So this ballot measure just barely passed. Do you think the result would have been different if there were no pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I was in Oklahoma earlier this year, right before the pandemic really hit and states started closing. And there was a lot of support then. And even then, when you talk to top Republicans, even though they didn't particularly support the measure, they weren't outright opposing it, talking about it all the time, like you had seen in the past when Republicans would rail on Obamacare. And so the message then was really save rural hospitals, bring dollars to Oklahoma. And when I was around the state there, I did see that that was resonating even pre-pandemic.
As some of the context here, Oklahoma is ranked second for the highest number of uninsured people in the country. So how much of an impact will a change to the law have?
Yeah, it's projected to cover about 200,000 people. These would be uninsured adults who make up to 138% of the poverty line, or a little over $17,000 for an individual.
The Republican governor, Kevin Stitt, wanted Oklahoma to be the first state to start using President Trump's plan to administer Medicaid differently. This would be in the form of block grants. So how would that work, and is that still on the table after voters have called on expanding Medicaid in a more traditional way?
Yeah, so essentially a block grant, Medicaid's financing structure is open-ended right now, and so this would give states defined payments from the federal government. And the block grant is currently at the federal government. It's at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Oklahoma has submitted that plan, and the federal comment period just recently ended. The governor has not withdrawn the plan as of now. Last week, a top health official had told me that the state wouldn't necessarily withdraw the block grant plan if the ballot initiative passes, saying that it was legal questions and they would play by the rules, but they had legal questions there. Yesterday, when I did ask the Oklahoma Medicaid agency this question, what their thinking was on that, they had a similar answer, saying that they'd work with the Trump administration and state leaders to reevaluate if this proposal was operative or not.
So why do Republicans like this block grant form better?
You're right. This is something the GOP has wanted for years. And their thinking is that it lets states take greater accountability for the health of their residents, is what Republicans would contend, and better control spending on Medicaid, which takes up a large chunk of state budgets.
Now, this timing on the vote is so interesting in Oklahoma, because just a week ago, the Trump administration asked the Supreme Court to consider overturning the ACA completely. Now, this week, we see a red state trying to expand it. Where does this leave us on the future of the Affordable Care Act? Because right now, it still seems pretty popular, even in some red states.
I think you're right that one of the things we have seen for the past decade is there are parts of the law that are really popular, making sure people who have pre-existing conditions can get covered has been very popular and is something that Republicans have said that they would want to keep. And one of the other things that we've seen over the past decade is more and more states expanding Medicaid. Even during 2017, when Republicans were crafting plans to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, halting Medicaid expansion was really politically difficult for them at the time.
You know, I spoke to the governor of Wyoming today, a Republican in another deep red state. Even he said that in this time with the pandemic and the economic conditions that the state is facing, that, you know, a conversation about Medicaid expansion should be on the table, at least open to the idea of it. So where do you see this going next? It's sure to come up in the election. And I know other states are also considering what they're going to do about their Medicaid expansions.
Yeah, I think up next is Missouri. Missouri has a ballot initiative that's similar to Oklahoma, and that is going to be voted on August 4th. Governor Mark Parson, he's up for re-election in November. He's been against the ballot initiative in the state. So I really think it'll be interesting to see how the governor messages this.
All right, that's Rachel Rubine, healthcare reporter for Politico. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Several animated TV series, including long-running hits such as The Simpsons and Family Guy, have made a decision to no longer use white actors for the voices of characters who are not white. That decision comes as the entertainment industry is under growing pressure to give more opportunity to non-white actors. For more on this, we're going to talk now to April Rain. She is the creator of the hashtag OscarsSoWhite, which has brought attention to the lack of diversity among Oscar nominees. Welcome, April.
Thank you for having me.
Let's give an example of what's at issue here first. We're going to hear a clip of voice actor Mike Henry, who is white. He's been playing Cleveland Brown, a black character on Family Guy. Let's hear a little bit of it now. His is the second voice. That's him saying, "And well."
You're alive!
And well!
We got to get out of here. The water levels are rising fast. I'll just grab an apple real quick.
Granny Smith, what do you got, an oven in your mouth?
Mike Henry played Cleveland Brown for 20 years. The decision to cast white actors like him to voice black and biracial characters, April, where does that come from?
That decision comes from the gatekeepers, who are overwhelmingly white men. Voiceover work, animation work is incredibly hard to get into. So when we have marginalized communities, non-white communities attempting to get their foot in the door, very often they can't, because once an actor comes in and does a good job, they get hired for more and more roles, which leads to this problem that we're having now.
So we should say that Mike Henry has stepped away from playing that character. And let's hear another actor, Jenny Slate. She announced her decision to step down as the voice of Missy, a biracial character on the Netflix series Big Mouth. Here's a clip of Missy. She has most of the dialogue here.
Oh, boy. Oy.
You okay over there, Missy?
This book is really good. It's called The Rock of Gibraltar. It won the Gerson Prize for Historical Fiction. You should read it for Gustavo alone.
Why is it inappropriate for an actor to portray another race?
Well, it's inappropriate not just in animation, but also in TV and film as well. What I've always said is that someone that is not part of that community won't have the context and background to fully flesh out what that means and give us more of a realization to what that person is going through.
So it doesn't happen a lot in this case, but is it inappropriate as well for an actor who is not white to play a white character?
Absolutely. It goes both ways. We are talking about, so we need to make sure that we're discussing why a specific character has been portrayed as white or has been portrayed as non-white, right? Why does it matter? Because what we know is that more diverse a project is, the broader the audience that will come into that project. And so when you have the opportunity to make a character any race, then perhaps choose someone who is non-white, whether that be Persian or Black or Latinx or Asian or AAPI, just to give more depth to the story. But absolutely, people who have the most context to play those particular characters are the ones that should get the opportunities. And that also gives the opportunities for the actors and actresses behind the scenes, behind the voiceover work, to get their foot in the door.
The changes that we've been talking about have come most recently. I'm guessing you think that much more needs to be done. What's the next step you would like to see producers take?
Well, I believe that the next step is to go back to the writing room, because if you're writing dialogue for a community, once again, that you are not a part of, you may not have the proper context or background for that dialogue. So if you are going to put black and brown faces on a screen, but there are no black and brown faces in your writer's room, then more work needs to be done there as well. Hollywood and everyone needs to take more steps to find the available talent and give them opportunities.
April Rain is the creator of the hashtag OscarsSoWhite, and she is vice president for content strategy of Ensemble, which is focused on telling the stories of marginalized communities. Nice to speak with you, April.
Thank you so much for your time.
American political and social movements tend to come with their own soundtracks, and today's protests in cities and towns across the country are no different. Claudia Meza of Oregon Public Broadcasting brings us this audio history of protest music in the U.S.
It's been an anthem all across the country, and the song goes like this. You about to lose your job!
Protest music has a deep and rich history in our country. One could even say it was born right alongside it. From Yankee Doodle being sung back in defiance at the British soldiers that originally wrote it to ridicule the American Revolution, to the spiritual sung in fields, unifying the voices of a people denied their own native languages, brought to a strange land to survive an insurmountable weight of violence. Protest music is American music. Now, the go-to material for marches and rallies has always been songs most well known by the crowd protesting. During the Civil War, it was the Battle Hymn of the Republic, a marching song based on a well-known folk hymn. New lyrics written by abolitionist Julia Ward Howe helped push the pro-union, anti-slavery movement's message by linking it to the Word of God. If this song sounds familiar to you, it's because this protest song has been used over and over again throughout history, in different movements. It's even still sung in churches, some with Howe's original anti-slavery lyrics.
Let us die to make men free, while God is marching on.
In 2015, Kendrick Lamar's track, All Right, off of his album To Pimp a Butterfly, became the unofficial anthem for the Black Lives Matter movement. And its message, we're going to make it through this. We're going to be all right, is reminiscent of the civil rights key anthem in old spiritual, We Shall Overcome.
We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome.
Many of our modern protest songs originated as spirituals, first brought to the United States by enslaved Africans. But as protesters become younger, viral video remixes have overtaken traditional popular music as a soundtrack for today's marches and rallies. Take, for example, this latest addition to the protest music pantheon.
Why are you detaining me? You about to lose your job. You about to lose your job. Get this dance. You about to lose your job because you are detaining me for nothing. You about to
lose your job. Lose Your Job hit hard and out of nowhere the first couple of weeks of June, making it to rallies all across the country from Los Angeles to New York City to Chicago to Seattle, which is where we heard that first clip at the very top of the story.
You about to lose your job!
And while it ended up in the streets, Lose Your Job started at a strip club.
What are you talking about? Why are you detaining me?
So way back in February, in a strip club parking lot in South Carolina, a black woman named Janiqua Charles was detained by security guard Julius Locklear. Her protests and cries to be let go soon turned into an ad-libbed song and dance that was recorded by others at the scene. Locklear took this video and then posted it to his own Facebook page with the following text. "Okay, I'm not posting this to be funny towards this subject," Locklear writes. "I'm posting it because that rap was lit, like I wish I could put a beat to it, LOL. And that's just what happened. Several DJs created remixes of Janiqua Charles' improv song. Once the George Floyd protests erupted nationwide and defunding the police became a rally cry, a new protest banger was born.
Why are you detaining me?
It hit its viral peak when veteran remix producers DJ Swayed, The Remix God, and iMarquise took it to its final form. Something that could have gone embarrassingly awry for Janiqua Charles has actually propelled her to a much better place. Homeless and dealing with drug addiction, that video led people to create a successful GoFundMe account to get her off the streets. And it could be because of the spirit in which the security guard, Julius Locklear, had posted the original video in, one of admiration rather than ridicule. But it could also be because Janiqua Charles did that thing that all good protest songs do. She gave the right words at the exact right time to a group of people who desperately needed to hear them. For Here and Now, I'm Claudia Meza.
You're listening to Here and Now.
As coronavirus surges in the United States, the hardest hit countries in Europe are reopening. One of them is Italy. More than 34,000 people have died from COVID-19. That's the fourth highest death toll in the world. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli is in Italy. And Sylvia, Italy is emerging after months of lockdown. Is there any semblance of normality there?
Pre-COVID normality? Not at all. But there is a kind of COVID coexistence that's beginning to take place. Almost all business sectors have reopened. Only discos are still closed, and outdoor discos will be allowed to open, but not until the middle of this month. But everywhere, there are very strict restrictions in place. Even at beaches, social distancing has to be respected. People have to wear face masks when entering shops and offices. And millions of Italians are still working at home. And, as for observing the rules, there's a generational divide. You see much more observance of health measures by the middle-aged and older people, while teenagers and those in their 20s tend to hang out in crowds and usually don't wear face masks, despite warnings from officials and medical experts.
The European Union is now open to international travelers. Not anybody, though, from the United States. The timing is good in one way for Italy because people will be allowed in from other countries. Not so good if you happen to be an American who wants to travel there. Tourism is hugely important to the economy. So what does this mean on both ends?
We've started seeing Europeans already showing up. There are a lot of Germans have come, and they've always been the nationality with the biggest number of visitors to Italy. Yeah, tourism represents 13% of Italy's GDP, and the absence of Americans this year will have a huge impact. More than 4 million Americans visited Italy in 2018, and they spent $3 billion. And, you know, many top hotels have not even reopened. Many restaurants in Rome are still closed. And it's going to be very tough summer for the industry. And since there's a lot of uncertainty about the virus, it's likely that Italians will also stay close to home and not travel far, even within their own country.
Would the experience of a traveler, say if an American could go there, would it be anything like what would have happened, say, last year? Or will enough places be closed? Or is there enough of Italy open to make it feel like you're there?
Oh, yes. Not only would you feel very much here. Now, there's a lot that's open, but first of all, you could enjoy the cities, the art cities.
That's
in a
right.
Way that
you can get
you
close
could,
to.
Probably it. Couldn't. It's been 100 years since, they're empty. They're gorgeous. You can see things. There are no crowds. And it's actually a beautiful experience in some ways.
So the timeline is quite different from Italy to the United States in terms of opening up after the pandemic or during the pandemic, as the case here. You're watching it from that perspective. You're also watching very carefully what's happening in the U.S. What kind of comparisons would you make?
Well, you know, Italians are the first to admit that they're not good at following rules and regulations. They're a bit of an anarchist streak here. But the pandemics transformed them very rapidly into a ask no questions, law-abiding nation. And when I ask people to explain this radical shift, everybody says fear of catching the virus. That means government officials and their scientific experts succeeded in getting the message out. And, you know, after a draconian lockdown, Italy had a huge death toll. But after a draconian lockdown, it got the curve down sharply. And that was thanks to a united nationwide effort. I think that's a key lesson for Americans that they can take from Italy.
NPR Sylvia Poggioli in Italy. Thanks so much, Sylvia.
Thank you, Lisa.
Today, the U.S. Labor Department reported that the jobless rate fell to 11.1% last month. That's better than most economists had expected as the economy bounces back from the coronavirus recession. After the news came out, President Trump held an impromptu news briefing. He claimed the virus is under control, and he took a bit of a victory lap.
This is not just luck, what's happening. This is a lot of talent. All of this incredible news is the result of historic actions my administration has taken working with our partners in Congress to rescue the U.S. economy from a horrible event that was formed, took place in China, and came here, and they could have stopped it.
Beth Fooey is senior politics editor for NBC and MSNBC, and she's watching the president and his comments. Beth, economists caution that today's job numbers are from before the current spike in coronavirus cases, mainly in the Sunbelt states. So did the president or any members of his team acknowledge concerns about what might be ahead for the economy and for the coronavirus, especially if states don't reopen businesses as quickly as they had planned to?
Well, yeah, I mean, to listen to President Trump, you'd think that everything was going great guns. He said that the third quarter was going to be like nothing before that anybody had ever seen. He sort of promised nothing but sunshine and roses and really sort of ignored the disaster that is unfolding across the country. I mean, number one, Lisa, he did get a very good number there on the jobs front, 4.7 million. And yet there are still 15 million fewer jobs today than there were in February. So we're still climbing out of a huge hole. And you alluded to the fact that many states are actually going to start seeing job losses again because they're having to close back down parts of their economy because of a resurgence of the pandemic. So no, President Trump is talking about something that simply is not the case across the country.
The Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says he's speaking with members of Congress about more help for taxpayers and businesses. Is that looking inevitable?
It's not really looking inevitable. There are definitely going to be some forms of relief that the Congress will continue on into the summer and later into the fall. The House, of course, the Democrat-controlled House, has indicated and has cast several votes talking about extending certain specific programs. But the Republicans have not yet been convinced. Mitch McConnell is sort of kind of putting the brakes on at this point in the Senate, saying they're really not going to take up anything until the end of July when they come back from their recess. And that gets very close to the end of July when a lot of the relief that passed previously is going to run out for taxpayers and for unemployed Americans. So we're going to see a lot of anxiety for people who have not gotten their jobs back and are really depending on that public help that may be drying up or at least being reduced toward the end of July.
Very briefly, in terms of face masks, the president urged people to take safety precautions, including wearing face coverings. Is this a sign that the president is aware he's out of step, not just with his medical advisors, but a majority of Americans on the issue?
It's amazing how reluctant he's been to fully embrace the face mask, given that at this point, most Republicans have stepped far away from him on this issue. We see Mike Pence now. He was in Arizona yesterday wearing a face mask. Liz Cheney, a member of Congress, posted a picture of her father, the former Vice President Dick Cheney, with a mask on. He's nobody's idea of a wimpy Democrat. He's a projects this notion that he's a big tough guy and look at him, he can wear a mask. More and more and more that even Republicans are stepping away from the president on this. And hopefully eventually the president will be willing to stand up and endorse, fully endorse the use of masks, wear one in public. And that might help steer some folks to putting on a mask and hopefully curbing this terrible pandemic.
Beth, what do you make of the campaign fundraising numbers that came out last night that show that Joe Biden has outraised President Trump in the presidential race for a second month in a row?
Yeah, well, it was pretty surprising because typically at this stage of a campaign, an incumbent president is going to be raising a lot more money than a challenger. So it's just the latest indication that President Trump's campaign at this point is in a fairly perilous place. We're seeing just poll after poll after poll showing Joe Biden leading the president both nationally and in battleground states. He is taking the lead now on fundraising, although President Trump does have a big war chest to that he raised earlier that he can fall back on. But the president is not in a good place right now. People are starting to have real concerns about his leadership around the issue of the pandemic, around the issue of race relations, and these are places where Joe Biden has really moved ahead in people's assessments. Right now, the only thing that President Trump is leading Joe Biden on in the polling is the economy. People think that he is a better steward of the economy. So that totally explains why he would step out today in front of cameras to tout those job numbers.
Beth Fooey, senior politics editor for NBC and MSNBC. Thanks a lot, Beth.
Thanks, Lisa.
The coronavirus pandemic has separated families from their loved ones in nursing homes around the country and created new challenges for staff who are trying to stop the virus from spreading in those facilities. Navigating this pandemic is hard for everyone, but it's especially complicated when you're caring for someone who has dementia. Miriam Wasser from member station WBUR reports.
Newbridge-on-the-Charles is a sprawling retirement community not far from Boston. It's run by Hebrew Senior Life and offers independent and assisted living options, as well as long-term memory care.
There are 20-some buildings on the campus. It has walking trails, and it's just it's a beautiful, beautiful campus.
That's Helene Oppenheimer. She and her husband Martin moved to Newbridge in 2011, shortly after he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. They lived together in an apartment at first, but as Martin's condition worsened, it became clear to Helene that he needed more help. So about 2 years ago, he moved to the memory care facility on the campus.
Martin, when we were sending him over to long-term care, he said, if that's where you think I should be, I trust you.
Even though the Oppenheimers both live on the Newbridge campus, they have to live in separate buildings. And Helene says it's been a stressful and emotionally difficult 2 years.
And he'll say to me, where am I? What kind of place is this that I'm in?
And that was before the coronavirus pandemic. Since mid-March, Helene hasn't been able to visit Martin. And that's been really hard.
I don't like being away from him. We have a wonderful marriage. Does he miss me? Yes, he misses me. He asks me all the time why I can't be there.
Families separated from loved ones in nursing homes are struggling everywhere. But when the person has Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, experts say the tension between infection control and maintaining daily routines makes the situation even more complicated.
One of the greatest challenges has been separating people from their loved ones, from their family members.
Dr. Olivia Liff is the geriatric specialist in Newbridge. She says losing that social interaction, along with canceled group activities and all the other changes, has been really hard for residents.
Oftentimes, people in memory support do better when they're together with other patients and the care providers that are regularly on the unit. And those people are sort of almost like family members in this setting.
No two people with dementia are exactly alike. But Liff says patients often exhibit behavioral disturbances like anxiety or agitation. In normal times, teams of specialists work together to help residents keep these behaviors at bay.
That becomes enormously challenging when we're treating people with the very strictest of infection control precautions.
What's more, a lot of the strategies other senior care facilities have implemented don't work with memory care patients. For instance, Liff says she can't expect any of her residents to quarantine in their rooms and wear masks. So instead, it's up to staff, who do wear masks, to adapt. They try to keep residents isolated, but they've also divided up floors in the memory care unit so that residents can only interact with a few other people should they walk around.
We know that any type of transition, even a transition within the building, can be a significant stressor. So we've been lucky, actually, to keep most of the patients in place.
The coronavirus pandemic poses another challenge for those working with dementia care patients. How much do you tell them about it? And what if they ask questions? That's something Helene Oppenheimer has thought about a lot in recent weeks.
One day when I called him, he got really upset. And he said, you know, something's here, something's come, a terrible thing has happened. We have something like the plague.
Helene says Martin upsets easily and gets anxious about her health and safety. So she didn't want to worry him more by telling him details about the pandemic.
And I said, it isn't the plague, but you're right, it's a terrible thing. And it has affected our ability to be together.
She knew it didn't really register, but it worked to calm him down.
I think he's indicated to me that he's a little scared over there when I'm not with him. And would he be scared if he really understood the pandemic? Yes, I'm sure he would be.
So for now, Helene is trying to take things with Martin day by day, calling him often, comforting him however she can, and, like many separated families, just waiting for the day when they can see each other again. For Here and Now, I'm Miriam Wasser.
And if you're a baseball fan, tomorrow is going to be a very big day. Because after a four-month pause, Major League Baseball's spring training, or maybe we should be calling it summer training at this point, is about to begin. Players will have to test negative for the coronavirus before they can start, and there are still pretty big doubts about how the shortened 60-game season will go, especially now that all minor league action has been called off for the rest of the year. Mike Pesca is Here and Now's sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, welcome. How is this plan for baseball going to work, the process for getting these players cleared and back on the field?
Right. So how it will go, of course, the big question is if it were will go, all of this discussion is against the backdrop of Anthony Fauci testifying that if things don't change, he could see, you know, we could see 100,000 new cases. And baseball knows this, but they have this plan in place that will include a regimen of testing. There are new oodles of new protocols, spacing on the bench, of course, on the bases, you know, tags will still be made. One change will be that managers can't go out and argue a call within 6 feet of an umpire. But I always thought managers going onto the field to argue calls was a basically pointless exercise. Connie Mack wore a suit, therefore wasn't allowed on the field, and was one of the five greatest managers in baseball history. So they do have all these rules in place. They hope that they'll be able to get the season in. Spring training starts now. Maybe they could start on the 23rd. But a 60-game season is, of course, not the baseball we know of. They just hope it will be some baseball at all.
Right. Normally 162 games. And, you know, this new rule strikes me. Extra innings will start with a runner on second base. I heard somebody say, what is this, Little League? That's very strange, Mike.
Well, they will not be hitting off a tee. That is good to know. But yes, they want to end the games. They're playing 60 games in 63 days. So these extra inning games that go 18 innings, 19 innings, it is the charm and appeal of baseball. There is no clock. On the other hand, there is no clock. And in a situation like this where time is of the essence and there is no rest, and rest is so important, they figure just get the games over. In the minor leagues where they tried this, the games do end earlier. There is usually a score in an inning when a player starts on second, so why not go for it, they figure.
You know, that actually does make sense now that you put it that way. But speaking of minor leagues, I feel very bad for these minor league players. They already hardly made any money at all, and their season now officially done.
Yes. So the minor leagues are important as a pipeline for development, but also just when players go down. And it is anticipated that they're going to have 60 player squads available to the teams, and they'll be able, the major league teams will be able to pluck players from these 60 player backup squads. But at the same time, you're right. Not only are these minor leaguers out of a deal, a lot of the teams might fold, the people who run the minor league say. It's a dire situation for a lot of the minor league franchises.
Mike, I want to get your thoughts on Ian Desmond. This is the Colorado Rockies outfielder. Describes himself as biracial, and he wrote a long and emotional post on Instagram recently saying that he's not going to play this season at all, partly because he's worried about the coronavirus, but also because he wants to focus on racial injustice. He wants the country to deal with that, and he thinks that baseball, the sport, needs a reckoning. What do you see in that story?
Yeah, so it was so emotional because he is a player, and he acknowledges this in his post, who always sort of kept his feelings to himself, his feelings about race. But in the post, he talks about having to tick off that biracial box when asked about it. He has a white mother. He acknowledges that, you know, navigating through the world was complicated, as people saw him as black, and he never really got to experience white privilege, yet at the same time was privileged enough to play baseball. But it is just so much for him as a veteran player, as a father, as someone who has been grappling with these issues, that he is taking time off to concentrate on America's systemic racism problems. And players in other sports, there is a raft of reasons why people are taking off from all the sports plans to start again. And they include issues of racial injustice. They include worries about health, totally legitimate worries. Ryan Zimmerman of the Nationals has a young child and an old mother, and he acknowledges he'll just not be able to see his mother for weeks and weeks and weeks if he goes inside the bubble. Also, Davis Bertans of the Washington Wizards is not playing because the Wizards have almost no chance to make the playoffs, and he stands to get a big contract unless he gets hurt in this abbreviated bubble season in the NBA. And I am pleased to say most people are not criticizing that. You don't get a lot of the kind of knuckle-dragging, old school, you got to play, it's for the team. People yeah. understand that that's a decision that he should make and that he can make.
Well, Mike Pesca, we had a little delay on that line and a few technical problems, so thanks for bearing with us. Mike Pesca is here and now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR, exactly, and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Long pause. I'm Peter O'Dell.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.